Hey everyone, Marco Werman here. If you're listening to this podcast and looking forward to hearing the latest news, but you have not yet donated to our end of 2020 campaign, you still have time. We need only 86 more people, just 86, to raise their hands and give in the final hours of the year. Donate $100 or more to the world and you'll receive an invite to a virtual party with me and the team. You'll get to ask questions, get access to exclusive behind-the-scenes stories, and much more. We need you. Your contribution allows us here at The World to continue to bring you the original global reporting you depend on. Donate today to help keep our independent journalism free and accessible to anyone in every corner of the globe. Visit theworld.org/give to donate today. Be one of the 86 to get us there. And from every one of us here at The World, thank you. I'm Marco Werman, and this is the last day of 2020.
I miss hugging my friends!
Yeah, I miss hugging my friends too. So today on the show, music, art, and videos that kept us mostly sane in an otherwise turbulent year. Plus the cultural legacy of another pandemic, the 1918 flu.
Attempts to contact the dead through seances, Ouija boards became very popular.
And pop music forges a connection to a new language in a new country. We get a kid's eye view from the days of audio cassettes. Twist and shout. Twisting and shouting for the next hour today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Happy New Year's Eve, my friends. You have made it through a doozy. I hope you're finding ways to relax today. I do, and maybe we can help, because today we're dedicating the show to music, movies, art, books, things we rely on to get us through normal times, and came 2020. And we leaned on pop culture more than ever for moments of levity, distraction, and yes, sometimes clarity during a chaotic year. So with the help of some of the world's reporters, we're looking back at the pop culture moments in 2020 that really stuck with us. Halima Gikandi in Nairobi, Jorge Valencia in Mexico City, and Bianca Hillier here in Boston all join us now. Thanks to all of you for doing this. It's probably the understatement of the year to say that the internet was a big part of our lives in 2020. Take us back, Bianca, to the early days of the pandemic when public health messaging collided with the internet.
So messages and guidelines from health officials were changing a lot in those early days. As we learned more about the virus, first everyone was told to stop touching their faces, and then, of course, stand 6 feet apart. But the line that really took off on the internet was wash your hands. You might remember saying happy birthday while you suds up, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And government agencies were doing whatever they could to get this message across. I think the PSA from Vietnam's Ministry of Health takes the cake. Listen to this. So the lyrics here are saying that people should be vigilant, raise awareness about good hygiene practices, and stay home so that Vietnam could beat the virus. Not surprisingly, attaching that catchy beat did the job. A famous dancer quickly choreographed some moves, and it wound up on TikTok, where millions of people got the message. Songs and memes like this spread fast during the pandemic, which is good when there's crucial information about how to stay healthy. But sometimes, Marco, as we know, it's a little too easy to hit retweet or share on social media. And a lot of people do so without fact-checking the information that they're sending. So it led to a lot of misinformation being spread online.
Right, going viral, as it were. Staying with the internet theme, let's go to another meme that emerged online this year. Halima, tell us about the Jerusalemma dance craze.
Yes, Jerusalemma. I feel like I've been hearing it on repeat all year. And this is a song that originally came out in December 2019. It means Jerusalem, of course, the holy city. And it was produced by this South African musician, Master KG, and features this amazing South African singer, Nomcebo Sikode. Here's a bit of it. Jerusalemma, ikayalami, ilondoloze. You can hear it sounds really upbeat. It kind of makes you smile. Even I'm smiling as I'm listening to this.
But really, the song went viral during lockdown. And there was a group of young people in Angola who released this video online called the Jerusalema Dance Challenge back in February. And since then, so many people have made their own versions of the dance, from medical workers in Europe. Recently saw a video from Dominican nuns in Spain. And here in Kenya, there have been videos made by policemen, videos made by politicians. And I think part of the reason it caught on is because, again, it's so upbeat. And here on this continent, I heard a lot of people talking about just being proud of being African, proud of African music. And for me, that's not really surprising, because the best thing about covering this continent for me is that I think we're always producing some of the best music and dance.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. So Jerusalema, a crucial pop moment for you, Halima. Jorge, let me turn to you, because in the Spanish-speaking world, there was another video that became wildly popular as a result of the pandemic. This was the Spanish film, The Platform.
Hay tres clases de personas. Los de arriba, los de abajo, los que caen.
All right, if you can't tell from the voice, this was a horror film, Jorge, during a dark time, and it shot to the top of the Netflix charts worldwide. Why did it resonate with people?
Yeah, and also I love how different of a tone this is from the songs we just heard from Vietnam and South Africa. This film took place in a prison where the prisoners are isolated and their access to food is scarce. Now, the film was made in northern Spain in Basque country, and it had its debut in the Toronto Independent Film Festival last fall, got picked up by Netflix, and it would have faded into obscurity, but then in March, the World Health Organization declared a pandemic. And the platform, or El Hoyo, as it's called in Spanish, skyrocketed to the top of the Netflix charts all over the Spanish-speaking world, all over the Middle East, globally with Netflix. So I spoke with the mind behind this film, Gardel Gaztelu Urrutia. He's the director. Mm. And it was the first time he received international recognition of this level. He said it was a bittersweet experience.
Porque sé que parte del éxito es debido a este momento tan triste que está viviendo el mundo. O sea,
so he says that it was bittersweet because he knew that in large part the reason for his success is because the world is experiencing its darkest moment that we have all collectively experienced in decades, and that people are connecting to that. So if you're into stress watching, Marco, this film is for you.
Well, streaming movies online has been practically the only viewing option this year. Of course, movie theaters are not COVID-friendly, and most have been closed for months. Meantime, we are stuck at home, isolating. That alone can be pretty stressful. Mm. We've done a lot of stories on the show this year about the mental health toll of COVID-19. How have we seen people coping via pop culture, Bianca?
So in the spring, we saw a ton of people stress baking, making things like cookies and bread, you know, that sourdough craze that really spread all over the world. Other people took up knitting or running. And then, Marco, others just started screaming.
Oh, my God.
That's just like someone screaming into the abyss?
Yeah, kind of. So people in Iceland have been doing this for decades, but it really did pick up steam again this year. Letting out a good scream can be cathartic, and there isn't really a wrong way to do it. So some people just go for it, like that wordless ball we just heard. But others get more specific. This is one from somebody in Iceland.
I miss hugging my friends!
I think that's a message that we can all stand behind. And yeah, I mean, these screams are kind of funny to listen to now, but there's a lot of research backing this up, saying that it is an effective way to release stress. Zoe Aston, a psychotherapist in the UK, told me it's a technique called primal therapy.
Primal therapy was a type of therapy that was used a lot in the 1970s. And rather than sitting and talking, they took people out into sort of wide open spaces, and they encouraged people to kind of let go of some of those really pent up emotions.
Pent up emotions like the ones that we've all been dealing with in 2020.
Yeah.
But Marco, if you want to try this, apparently the key is to put your hand on your belly, bend your knees, and go for it. So good luck with that.
Yeah, I'm not going to do that right now. I might blow out the microphone, but I will later, promise. So let's say the opposite of screaming is laughing. Comedy has also helped this process 2020. Halima, tell us about what's been making you laugh this year.
Yeah, definitely. we all need a laugh sometimes. And one person I've been laughing at is this young Kenyan, like 19 years old woman named Elsa Majimbo. And she lives here in Nairobi. And she became famous during the coronavirus lockdown. She's been releasing these short, very snippy videos on social media that are hilarious. And it's hard to explain why. But in most of the videos, she's dressed in like house clothes that here in Kenya, you would never wear in public. And at the end of the punchline, she'll eat these chips to kind of accentuate the jokes. And here's one of them that she released about kind of the coronavirus pandemic.
I wanted to meet up, but ooh, it's a pandemic. I would have let you come to my house, but like, oh, pandemic. Really, really wanted to see you, but like,
of course, if you can't hear the sarcasm in her voice, it's kind of looking at the bright side of the pandemic, which is, you know, yes, there are people you want to see who you can't, but there could be people who you don't want to see who you may not have to.
It's the all-purpose excuse.
Exactly. So what will we do after the pandemic? And sometimes, I mean, that's kind of what she's known for. Other times she'll just release these jokes that are just kind of brutal comedy that really hits to the reality of the 21st century. Here's another one of her jokes.
If you're using my Netflix, I own you. You're mine. You're mine. When I cough, you come running. You sprint.
But at the end of the day, for me, it really just reminds me of how young this continent is and that social media during coronavirus has given some people, you know, opportunities to kind of become famous or to make money or just make people laugh.
Yeah, proof of concept, though. We were all having a good chuckle there. We've been talking a lot about videos people created this year, and yet it seems like a difficult time to be creative. Jorge, you spoke with some writers about that this year.
Yeah, Marco, I became interested in this because for a lot of people, a way to release their stress is to do things with their hands, to do knitting, to do painting. But for people who are in creative fields who have to do it for a living, it perhaps wasn't coming as easily. I spoke to Fernanda Melchor. She is a writer here in Mexico. She wrote this wonderful book called Hurricane Season. It was published this year in English, has been translated into more than a dozen languages. But when I spoke to Melchor, she said that she was having a hard time writing. And so what she recommends for people is turning to poetry.
It is really hard now to find words to explain what we are feeling, don't you think? For me, it's really difficult. We can talk about solitude. We can talk about desperation. We can talk about loneliness. But at the same time, it's really difficult to find the exact words to describe. And I'm a person who does that for a living, you know? So maybe taking words from another person, from a poet, I think it helps to make clear what we're feeling.
Fernanda Melchor says that she likes to read the poem of the day from the Poetry Foundation. And they actually have a very nice newsletter that will send it to your mailbox every day if you want it. But anyway, Marco, I have a question for you, because anybody who listens to the show often knows that you are pretty well clued in to pop culture in many corners of the world. So if I can turn the tables, I was wondering, what stood out to you? What were some of the moments that stood out to you?
Gee shucks. Well, there are two. The first one is we saw this with the Kardashians and the Beckhams and politicians, from the mayor of Austin, Texas, to one of Boris Johnson's aides. Elites flaunting the rules and advice, trotting off to deserted islands and luxury lairs in the countryside where they are sealed off from pandemic planet. I mean, it's a bad pop culture moment, and the example set by these A-listers doesn't help things. None other than public health law expert Lawrence Gossin told us this the other day.
You know, the most important thing is that for opinion shapers, they need to mask, they need to socially distance, and they need to not travel.
So kind of a news you can use pop culture moment. My other is a moment from along a highway. Nathan Apodaca, 420 Dogface 208, cruising along on a longboard deck, swigging from an Ocean Spray cranberry juice bottle, lip-syncing to Fleetwood Mac's Dreams, sending sales of cranberry juice as well as Fleetwood Mac soaring. It was cool, but it made me wonder why some videos get millions of views and others get nada. I don't have an answer to that. Nathan also shows the power of TikTok for creating 15 minutes of fame. I mean, he's a former potato farmer from Idaho. It's a rags-to-riches story. He became so famous, in fact, we can stay updated on his news. For example, he traded his Nissan Frontier that he received as a gift from Ocean Spray for a Chevy Silverado that he wanted. We also recently learned, sadly, that he got COVID and has since belted out, "I Will Survive." So I'm wishing Nathan the best.
Also, "I Will Survive" should be the theme song of all 2020 around the world and for next year, too.
Totally. The World's Halima Gikandi, Jorge Valencia, and Bianca Hillier, thank you all very much. This was fun.
Thanks, Marco.
Thanks so much, Marco.
Thanks, Marco.
Coming up, a trip to the museum, COVID style. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. It's been a while since most of us have gone to a museum. According to some social media, what art lovers really miss is, wait for it, a nice butt. In bronze, or sculpted from marble, of course. A social media campaign over the summer caught our attention. The Yorkshire Museum in the UK started a competition of sorts using the hashtag Best Museum Bum. No big surprise that went viral. Lucy Crichton, Yorkshire Museum's curator of archaeology, kicked off the campaign with the derriere of a Roman statue.
We chose this Best Museum Bum because it's just a fantastic piece of Roman art.
The Best Museum Bum campaign sparked all kinds of originality and inspiration.
There have been bums from the animal kingdom, both in taxidermy variety, but also living animals, but also museums that don't have traditional collections got really creative. And we had the bums of ships and of other vehicles like trains.
When I spoke with Lucy Crichton, it struck me that when you think about it, bums are everywhere in museums.
You're right that all museums have bums in one form or another. And there's something universal about the human body. It's been a subject of art and historical objects throughout history.
Sure, bums are great and we can all relate to them, but there might be something else going on here, making the highbrow a little more lowbrow.
I think museums having fun on social media can perhaps help to break down some of those perceived barriers to access that museums can face.
To see a collection of Best Museum Bums, and you know you want to, head over to theworld.org. Now, during the pandemic, museums around the world had to find new ways of sharing their collections online, and not just the bottoms in the collection. The Museum of Modern Art in New York was no different. MoMA presented an audio project to tell stories about how art inspires and informs us, told by people who usually don't get to do the talking at museums, the security guards. The World's Sarah Birnbaum has our story.
When the Museum of Modern Art isn't closed, Kevin Reed spends 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, standing in the galleries keeping watch over the art. He says from time to time, people acknowledge him, but not really.
Most people just come in here, they just ask us a question and just go.
Like, where's the bathroom? How do I get to the cafeteria?
At least address me first before you just like, hey, where's this? Like, hey, how are you? How you doing?
The artist Chemi Rosado Seijo knows guards have much more to tell you than where the bathroom is. He put together a new audio guide for the museum called Beyond the Uniform, which you can listen to online even though the museum is closed.
Hi there. Hola, buen día. ¿Qué tal? My name is Chemi Rosado Seijo. I am an artist from Puerto Rico.
In the guide, 9 guards, including Kevin, choose a piece of art from the MoMA's collection and talk about it. Altogether, there are 20 audio essays. Little jewels, really. This is the first one, where Chemi explains his inspiration for the guide. And that's Kevin singing in the background. Because, by the way, Kevin's a musician.
One thing that I've been noticing through the past probably 20-something years is that most security guards, they are black. Or they are brown people, as they call us, yeah. Puerto Ricans or Colombians or Dominicans.
Mr. Invisible, does it make sense to you? People look through you, but don't see what's in you. I'm standing right in front of you. You ain't looking hard enough, yes.
I thought that's the community I want to work with. A lot of these guards are artists themselves, and that's a big reason why they work here. They want to be surrounded by these pieces of art, and they want to protect it too. And actually, they want to tell you more than it's on the walls.
For Kevin's contribution to the guide, he chose to talk about a painting by the African-American artist Kerry James Marshall called Untitled Policeman. It's a monumental portrait of a black policeman perched on the hood of his cruiser, painted in 2015.
It's a very, very provocative piece, and it's just telling of the world that I'm living in right now. It connects so much. Black Lives Matter, the senseless police shootings, injustice, prejudice.
Black men are pretty much invisible in the history of Western painting, both as artists and as subjects. And when they do appear in paintings, they're usually supporting characters or some exoticized fantasy. But not in this portrait. Here, the policeman is front and center, and he's looking off to the side. You have no idea what he's thinking.
He's in this uniform. He's doing his job, but they don't see that this man probably is just working to feed his family. Once he takes off the uniform, he could be somebody different. It could be that he's conflicted with doing his job. This man is probably just sitting down. It's like, they only knew who I really was.
Kevin finds meaning in a portrait. Rabila Kanak, another security guard, finds meaning in a landscape. A pretty famous one.
When I started working here, every visitor asks, where is the starry night? Where is the starry night? And then I realized, I really want to know what is this piece is.
In Vincent van Gogh's Starry Night, painted in 1889, the sky is alive with swirling, roiling patterns. The stars, moon, and planets glow in circles of yellow and white light. Underneath the turbulence lies a sleepy village. Starry Night was painted in the French countryside, but it looks familiar to Rabila.
I'm originally from Bangladesh. My village is similar to this painting. The night is more richly, more alive than the day. And these paintings, I believe, he created like early morning before sun rising. So sometimes when I have to decide something, I wake up that time, I look outside from the window, and I have some thought like that.
The artist Chemi Rosado Seijo says he hopes these audio guides give other people permission to connect to art in a personal way.
I do expect that people are like, oh, so the guards are talking about their artworks. I can talk about the artworks.
Chemi says that all too often he'll be talking to somebody about art, and then all of a sudden they'll censor themselves.
Saying, I don't know about art, I should not be talking about it. Or, I don't really know about it, but I like it or I dislike it. And for me, that's the important part, is that why you like it, why you don't like it, from your own very own perspective. And it's valid.
And now when everyone is stuck at home, it's actually a great time to go online, connect with some art, listen to Kevin and Rabila and the other guards talk about it, and see how it speaks to you. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
Sarah brought us that story in April. Today, December 31st, is your last chance to experience the audio project Beyond the Uniform. It's online at MoMA.org. More stories about art, books, and music that gave us hope in 2020. That continues just ahead on this New Year's Eve. You're listening to The World. Hi, Marco Werman here, pausing the show for one of the last times this year, I promise. These final hours of 2020 are crucial for The World's fundraising campaign. We need just 86 more people to complete our goal of 1,000 donors. That's you. Yep, you, listening while you're making dinner, or over your morning coffee, or while you're cleaning the house. No matter when you listen, now is the time to act. We're incredibly grateful to each and every one of our donors, and we want to meet you. Donate $100 or more to The World today, right now, and you'll receive an invite to a virtual party with me and The World team. Visit theworld.org/give to donate today. Remember, you only have until the end of this crazy year to join. Go to theworld.org/give. And from everybody here at The World, thank you so much. Musicians in a pandemic have to follow the rules.
To test, I feel like my nostrils feels like 22, 23 times I was tested, you know, before, during, after. They announced that then it's changing or it's canceled. Sometimes it's like three people literally in a vast theater.
We speak with jazz duo Mino Sinelu and Niels Petter Mulvaire just ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH and PRX. The 1918 influenza pandemic, we must remember, was also a huge historic event. It infected roughly a third of the entire global population. And yet, there are not many novels about the 1918 influenza, not like there are about World War I that happened at around the same time. The flu doesn't have an All Quiet on the Western Front or Johnny Got His Gun. Downton Abbey fans might remember this moment when Matthew Crowley's fiancée Lavinia got it.
I don't understand. When I was with her, she was talking. She was fine.
It's a strange disease with sudden, savage changes.
Scholar Elizabeth Outka has looked at why this cataclysmic pandemic a century ago seems mostly lost in our cultural memory. Outka is the author of Viral Modernism, The Influenza Pandemic, and Interwar Literature.
I call it a perfect storm of silence because I think that there's a lot of factors that go into why the influenza pandemic drops out of cultural memory. But a lot of it does have to do with the timing. It comes right as the war is ending, and the deadly second wave came right at armistice. In fact, a lot of people were infected with influenza in the armistice celebrations. And so you have a lot of people just overwhelmed with grief, overwhelmed with mass death. You know, it was 8 to 10 million people who die in World War I, and people had just had enough.
So perhaps the experience of the pandemic comes through art and literature in more subtle, maybe unexpected ways. You also argue that the idea of zombies, the undead monsters who come back and infect other humans, that can be traced back to the same period. How?
What you have is this combination of factors from the war and the pandemic. You have bodies that have been disfigured in the war or from the pandemic. This influenza turned people purple. It caused profuse bleeding from eyes, nose, and mouth. And you have all this insecure burial, right? You have so many missing soldiers. You have so many mass graves. And in the flu, the worst wave came in the middle of winter when it was hard to dig. And then you have this invisible enemy that is also contagious. You could give it to other family members. You could pass it on. Mm. And so all of these factors combine. And lurching out of this come these proto-zombie figures with a writer like H.P. Lovecraft. And in a very famous movie, Jacques Hughes, by the French director Abel Gance, it was a way, I think, also of visualizing a monster that was invisible in the case of the flu.
What other ways did kind of culture producers come to terms with the pandemic? Like Arthur Conan Doyle, the author of the Sherlock Holmes series, he has an interesting role here.
We have a resurgence of what was called spiritualism after the war and the pandemic, which was an attempt to contact the dead through seances. Ouija boards became very popular. And so Arthur Conan Doyle, who created Sherlock Holmes, was extremely interested in spiritualism. His son is often reported as having died from injuries of the war. But that's actually incorrect. He was injured in the war, but he dies of influenza when he comes back, along with Arthur Conan Doyle's younger brother. And so Arthur Conan Doyle throws himself into spiritualism. He's coming to the United States and giving sold-out talks at Carnegie Hall. And he's showing these spirit photographs where you have a living sitter, and then in the background somewhere, there's a ghostly figure of ideally one of their relatives. Now, to our eyes, these seem like obvious frauds, but at the time, it offered a tangible way to bring back somebody who had died in these terrible ways. And it was a way of handling that kind of grief and giving somebody a visual that they could hang on to.
So, Elizabeth, you've written a book about this subject. Obviously, you started working on it long before the current coronavirus pandemic. But now that we're all living this strange experience, were there any particular works that you've read before that kind of took on a new relevance for you?
One of the poems that I write about in the book is the famous poem by William Butler Yeats, The Second Coming. Mm. And it is a poem very much about the war. It is very much about all the things that were happening in Ireland. But when I had my own sort of COVID-like case in March, I remembered lying in bed, sort of semi-delirious, and thinking about the rhythmic quality of these lines and the way they produce or suggest a kind of delirium, this turning and turning and things fall apart. The center cannot hold, mere anarchy is loosed upon the world, right? These are all lines that spoke to the kind of bodily disintegration, this sort of sense that there was anarchy outside your window and anarchy inside your body. And Yeats writes this poem just a couple weeks after his pregnant wife had barely recovered from her almost deadly case of influenza.
Elizabeth Outka is a professor at the University of Richmond. She's the author of Viral Modernism, the Influenza Pandemic, and Interwar Literature. Elizabeth, we are glad you're healthy. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much, Marco. It was a pleasure.
A musician's life is usually spent on the road. We heard from a lot of artists this year whose lives are not what they're used to, like jazz guitarist George Benson.
In the many years I've been on the road, I've never been home for a whole summer.
Other musicians found ways to perform, playing on rooftops for free, or moving their concerts to empty museums, like cellist Camille Thomas.
I played in the theater of Marie Antoinette, and I could really feel her spirit there.
Yeah, the life of a musician in 2020 was so much different. It was also a tough year to release new music. Mino Sinelu and Niels Petter Mulvaer are two artists who had to navigate this bizarre year, but still managed to be productive, releasing a smoking new recording called Sulla Mariana. Mino Sinelu is French and played with Miles Davis as percussionist and multi-instrumentalist. Niels Petter Mulvaer is from Norway and plays trumpet. They had planned to tour this year to promote the album, but between lockdowns and Niels himself getting COVID, plans were nixed. When I spoke with both musicians recently, Niels was still on the road to recovery.
I'm better. I'm out of the hospital, but not fully recovered. There is some things with the taste and the... I played some concerts, solo concerts, and actually at the end of, like after an hour, I could really feel like there is something which is not working properly in the lungs. So it takes time.
And breathing, I mean, it's part of your work as a trumpeter. I mean, it's super important.
Yeah, but I improvise. So if I feel really tired in the lungs, I just take a little break and then I play again.
So that was one speed bump with 2020 for the both of you. Mino, how were you able to carry on with the tour? I mean, Niels is, after all, one half of this project.
Yeah, and thankfully, so to speak, we both have a strong background of playing one-man shows, solo concerts. And I had more time than he had to recover because I was hit in March with COVID as well.
You got so, it too.
Yeah, and I was... quiet about it, but we spoke a lot with Neil when Niels was sick, and you know, no advice. I just my own experience was showing that it's possible to get out of it, you know. And for a French gourmet, the test is very important, and it's not fully recovered, but to keep it light a bit. But we're all here, and we are warriors.
I was going to ask you because, I mean, as jazz musicians, you're both improvising off the page and now you're improvising with scheduling the road. Before the tour got basically canceled, what was the practical side of touring during a pandemic? What was that like? Were venues testing you? Did you insist on that? And what about the audiences?
Yes, all of the above. Under the test, I feel like my nostrils feels like 22, 23 times I was tested, you know, before, during, after. You just never know. You have a concert, and a week before, and then 2 days after, they're announced, and then it's changing or it's canceled. Sometimes it's like three people literally in a vast theater. So, I mean, it's all of the above, and the same with Niels.
Well, yeah, I have just been traveling in, basically in Norway since I was infected and got sick. The tour that Mino talked about, that is the one that we were supposed to do together. And we had plans to travel the world, basically, from August to Christmas. So, but the way it ended up.
This really was a year of improvisation for both of you. Let's get to the music from the album, the product of this year, Sulla Mariana. I know the title is a combination of two worlds, both of your worlds. Niels, can you explain?
Yeah, it's Sula is the island I come from, which is like in the northwest of, it's just the entrance into the fjords of Norway. And Madiana is the original word for Martinique, I guess.
Mm. And Martinique, you've got roots in Martinique, right, Mino?
Yes, my father was from there, and it was also called by the autochtones Madiana, the island of flowers, and Madinina as well.
He comes from the island of flowers, and I come from the island of moss and rocks and fog.
It's a great way to sum it up. But, so,
but there was
so what does that mean
some,
for the music? If one of you comes from the island of flowers and the other comes from the island of moss and fog, what does that do to the music?
We share the same passion, which is music and life, that is, you know.
Mino and Niels, lots of people are feeling the changes in their lives in the pandemic. And given what both of you have been through this year, have you started to think about like the new normal for you and musicians when it comes to making your art, especially the group kind of work, composing together and producing a recording, releasing it, touring it?
The thing that is not happened now is that you can just put up a really long tour. Mm. Like you can go on a European tour for 3 weeks or something. I don't know when that will happen. And going from country to country, you have to be like 10 days in a quarantine, you know?
Make life hard.
It's...
You can learn the language. You can immerse in the culture. This is, come on, positive. The glass
That's seeing the positive
full.
Side, definitely.
How full.
I do like that optimism. Percussionist Mino Sinelu and trumpeter Niels Petter Mulvaire. Their latest album is called Sula Mariana. A happy new year and a happy 2021 to you both, and I hope to see you on a stage real soon.
Same to you.
Thank you, guys, and peace. Bye-bye.
Ghana in West Africa is famous for its textiles, vibrant colors and striking patterns. Look closer, though, at the fabric produced by one Ghanaian textile company, and you'll notice certain things. Padlocks, airplanes, keys. This series of cloth prints was inspired by the coronavirus pandemic. The Reverend Stephen Badu is with Ghana Textile Printing in Tema, Ghana. He spoke with my colleague Carol Hills.
Stephen, describe some of the designs in this series. What kind of motifs are we seeing?
We looked at the lockdown measures that were put in place by the president, President Nana Akufo-Addo. So we came up with motifs that suggest or that depict some of the measures. So for example, one of the images is the use of plane, the plane engine in the way it's saying that airplanes were all grounded, no flights were allowed in or out of the country.
I know one of your designs shows a pattern featuring a round pair of glasses. What's the significance of that?
We got that inspiration from President Nana Akufo-Addo. Since March this year, he's been addressing the nation through televised broadcast. And every time he comes to address the nation, he has a trademark spectacle, very small rounded spectacles that he wears. And that stands out in his face. And so for us, that became like the key motif to represent his leadership and how he managed the whole COVID-19 pandemic in our country.
I want to ask you what inspired this series. I mean, you're putting images into your fabric that relate to a pandemic, which is kind of, you know, it's kind of depressing and sad. Why bring images of that to fabric and textiles?
It's a question that almost everybody asks. Why did we even think about putting an image of something that is so bad into a fabric? As a company, we are storytellers. We tell our stories through designs and colors. Okay, so in Ghana, almost every major things that happen, we try to express that through our designs. So the question we ask ourselves is, how do we tell the story of COVID-19 in a positive light? How do we put a positive twist to this whole pandemic? And so far, it's been received quite well.
Has the textile industry in Ghana been hit hard by the pandemic?
Yes, the pandemic indeed slowed down sales drastically. Prior to the pandemic, we were selling an average of about 1 million yards per month. By the close of the month of March, our sales had dropped to about over 100,000. And so really, it affected us really, really badly. So for us, the introduction of our new collection sort of brought some energy, fresh, positive energy to the industry. People were just enthused about the whole idea of a COVID-inspired fabric. And out of that curiosity, people felt, let me get a piece just to remember, show it to my children, show it to my grandchildren, that once upon a time, something like COVID-19, a pandemic of this nature, came upon the world. So I think that's what inspired a lot of people to go out there and pick a piece to keep for memory.
I understand that you have a series of new COVID-inspired designs. What can we expect to see?
We call this collection, which we introduced the 1st of September, we call it "This Too Shall Pass." For example, the first design has motifs that depict movement from a state of barrenness to a better state of flourishing. So you'll find like a tree, for half part of the tree, the leaves are all withered and it's very barren and there's a drought all around. The other half of it, it shows a flourishing tree, you know. So basically it's to say that, yes, today there is barrenness, there's drought, there's famine, everything is withered, but there is hope that once the rains come, this same tree would flourish. So it's a way of giving Ghanaians and indeed the world at large hope that we will survive this COVID.
Reverend Stephen Kofi Badu, thanks so much.
All right, thank you too.
The Reverend Stephen Badu is the marketing director of Ghana Textile Printing in Tema, Ghana. He spoke with The World's Carol Hills. If you're like me, by now you've read, let's say, a few year-end lists. We have one more for you, a super list of sorts, from some of our favorite books of the year to some captivating dance challenge memes. Find the pop culture moments that got us through 2020. That's all at theworld.org. You remember your first favorite band as a kid? How their music connected you to a cultural scene, shaped a part of your personality, and made you sing loudly into your hairbrush? Reporter Lucia Benavides remembers that feeling, and she has the tapes to prove it.
Valerie Jennin was my first friend in the United States. We met just months after I moved to Austin, Texas. I was 9 years old, and she lived down the street. And just like me, she loved the Beatles.
Welcome to Beatle News!
It was 1998, years before podcasts were a thing. Our studio was my parents' living room. We recorded our radio program over a few years, using a cassette player with a mic. Our audience was small, just us. Our focus was constant. The Beatles.
Now, today there's something sad we need to tell you about George Harrison.
We reported on the latest news, including when an intruder attacked George Harrison and his wife in 1999, nearly killing them.
It was December 30th, morning 4 a.m.
Most of the program, though, was us singing. Maybe you can hear my accent. And I didn't know all the words I was saying. Back in Argentina, I sang along with the Beatles by making up words or mimicking their pronunciation. But when my parents moved me and my brothers to Texas, I was instantly surrounded by English. The only thing that seemed to exist both in Argentina and the US were four mop tops from Liverpool.
Hey, Lucy, I got a surprise for you.
What is it?
It's a song from the Beatles, I mean.
What is it called, the song?
It's called Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds.
Here it goes.
The Beatles have always felt like home, but there's never been a place that I've felt a part of. I always introduce myself as Argentine, but when I go to Argentina, I don't get certain references and sometimes make mistakes in Spanish. But I also don't feel like I belong to the US. There's always some small cultural difference, or the fact that I eat dinner at 10 p.m. But I'm not alone in feeling this way.
My name is Santiago Benavides. No, perdón.
I called up my brothers, Santiago and Emiliano, or Santi and Emi. They're twins and were 6 years old when we moved to Texas. Now they're 28. Santi is a physicist and Emi a translator. He speaks 10 languages. We still speak Spanish with each other, but switched to English for the interview.
I get obsessed with like other countries and other languages, and I think in a way it's like I want to belong.
I mean, yeah, I have the same feeling. In a way, it's also more interesting, I think, to kind of have like a mix of different backgrounds and stuff like that. And
but do you think that you'll ever feel like you belong somewhere?
I do think like I belong, but it's not a nationality. It's like my life choices, right? Of like being a scientist and like my
home can be something you create for yourself. But I guess I'm still trying to figure out what that means for me. For a long time, music was my identity, but now it's veered into storytelling.
Welcome to Beatle News.
Our voices are so high.
20 years later, Valerie and I are still in touch. She still lives in Texas, where she directs a choir and sings professionally now. I'm far away in Barcelona.
It's like funny because I don't remember specifically how much English you actually spoke. All I just remember is that like we seem to get along.
But like how much do you remember it being like the Beatles, like the thing that we had in common?
Oh no, that was a huge part of it, because like that was like our thing.
You know, Valerie, I've never thought of this, but
are you recording?
Yeah. But
that's towards the end of Beatle News. I was 12 by then, my accent completely gone. We were still trying to figure out who we were, our likes, our dislikes, our looks.
We're really lucky that we have music. You know, back 100,000 million years ago, dinosaurs didn't have music, and all they could do is walk around and eat plants. But now we have bangs either. And now we have pop, rock, rap, whatever you can think of.
And bangs.
And thanks to the Beatles, people wear bangs.
Yeah,
like me.
I was trying to make my point.
During that time, the Beatles gave me a home, a way to connect. Or at the very least, the Beatles gave us bangs. For the world, Lucia Benavides, Barcelona.
Ooh, take it a baby now. Twist and shout.
I love that story. Now, when it comes to Indian classical music, Zakir Hussain is a legend, and he's added a new album of previously recorded music to the repertoire.
And now Ustad Ali Akbar Khan Sarod, Indranil Bhattacharya Sitar, and Zakir Hussain Tabla will perform rags Kafi Jila Kafi, followed by rag Bhairavi.
That Which Colors the Mind is the title. Hussain believes the music on it probably is the highest quality recording he's ever heard of Indian ragas, the bedrock of musical patterns from the Asian subcontinent. If there's one person to credit for the sonic quality of this new album, it's the guy who'd become the sound man for the Grateful Dead, Owsley Stanley. The performance he recorded of Zakir Hussain and Ali Akbar Khan in 1970 in San Francisco occurred on the eve of Owsley's 2-year sentence for possession of LSD. It was a crazy time. For a host of global musicians who descended on the Bay Area, it was also a time of total creativity.
I would say like a global musical renaissance happening in the Bay Area, because there were musicians from Africa, from Middle East, from Indonesia, from Japan, from India, of course, everybody was here. And there was this growing awareness among musicians who were native of this place that there was a lot of music in the world that they should connect with and broaden their horizons.
Thank you. Just a taste of an incredible recording of Indian ragas produced by the man who once told police he was the king of acid. We'll bring you that story in the new year. Until then, we leave you with these transcendent sounds that came out of that session, classical music from India, that also in these times is most welcomed. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio, I'm Marco Werman, wishing you health, peace, and strength in 2021. And as always, thank you for listening.
From PRX.